Hello and welcome to the OT Schoolhouse Podcast, your source for school-based occupational therapy tips, interviews, and professional development. Now, to get the conversation started, here is your host, Jason Davies. Class is officially in session.
Hey there, and welcome to episode 140 of the OT Schoolhouse Podcast, your dedicated resource for practical strategies and actionable insight in the world of school-based occupational therapy. I'm your host, Jason Davies, and I am so happy to have you here as we dive into the world of ADHD today. In this episode, I am thrilled to introduce you to Lori Flynn, a highly experienced school-based occupational therapy practitioner with over two decades of expertise. Out of need, Lori has devoted much of the last several years to understanding and supporting the unique needs of students with ADHD in the classroom, making her the perfect guest for today's enlightening discussion. Like many of you, Lori has seen a dramatic increase in the number of students referred to her due to concerns stemming from a student's ADHD. As a result, she took it upon herself to learn everything she could about ADHD from all perspectives, attending conferences, reading, online courses, everything. Now she's ready to share some of what she has learned with all of us. In today's interview, Lori and I will first discuss ADHD and some of the common areas of concern relative to ADHD. After that, I asked Lori to walk us through a case study of sort to provide valuable insights and strategies for evaluating and effectively supporting students who exhibit traits associated with ADHD. Specifically, we'll explore the impact of the natural environment on ADHD symptoms and its influence on standardized testing, assessment tools and evidence-based strategies for supporting students with ADHD, including the use of the WISC to assess cognitive proficiency and working memory. And finally, we'll also discuss practical tips for fostering strong collaborations between OT practitioners, teachers, parents, and students to create environments conducive to academic success for students with ADHD. As an OT practitioner, evaluating and providing effective services to students with ADHD is crucial. By walking through the evaluation and discussing therapy interventions with us, you'll gain practical insights and tools to tailor your intervention plans and accommodations that are conducive to the success of students with ADHD in the classroom. So, get ready to use that 15-second rewind button as Lori drops some serious knowledge today, and tune in to the complete episode to equip yourself with the knowledge you need to support your students. Let's go. Lori, welcome to the OT Schoolhouse Podcast. Thank you so much for being here. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I'm so excited. You know, I mean, it's probably been about half a year now, maybe even a little bit more, that I've started to see these posts show up on my Instagram feed, and they're all about ADHD and how we can support students as occupational therapy practitioners in school, those with ADHD. And I just love what I'm seeing. So I had to reach out, and yeah, I'm looking forward to this. I hope you are as well.
I am. That's great. I'm glad it reached you.
Yeah, definitely. Right. Like, that's what's really cool about social media. You know, it's we can get out there and share our message with the world. And I guess like the first thing I want to get started with is where you are as an OT today and kind of how you got started with this Instagram with OT for ADHD.
Well, all right. I'm a practicing school-based OT in New York in a teeny tiny school. And I started, I've been practicing for 22 years. So I'm going to say about half of my practice ago, I started seeing such an increase in students with ADHD, just in general. Mm-hmm. And then they were the kids that just weren't generalizing. They weren't generalizing what we were doing in our sessions and back to the classroom. And now I started a long time ago. So it was pullout was the only real way I started doing OT, which I have evolved, but at the time it bugged me. I just couldn't figure out why. So I started researching just on my own and doing some continuing education on ADHD to try to figure out that piece, why they were one child in my room and a totally, totally different child in the classroom. And it would throw me. So it really just started becoming something that I was upskilling on my own for no other reason.
Yeah, that's awesome. I mean, that's, I think that's how a lot of us get into a specialty area, right? Like we start a little broad and then something starts to hit us in one way or another. And for you, it was, you know, seeing more students with ADHD and you just kind of went off and ran with that. I want to ask you then, for you, what was your preferred method for learning more about ADHD? Was it reading research articles? Was it buying books? I know you just went to a conference, but was that kind of what you did at first, or how did you get started?
At first, I'm a real big reader. I was reading books, and then I was reading research articles. And then I laughed because I was like, I'm not fun at parties anymore. I read the citations on the research article and then read those articles. And that was becoming what I do at night. And I was like, oh God, what happened to me? Because there was no OT ADHD information. I mean, what I had, I exhausted in a day. There was none.
I love that you brought that up because I still feel that way. Like, is that
true? Canada's better.
Okay.
Canada, I get more out of Canada. But no, it is true. When you do, if you just like go on AOTA and you research and you do all the journals, I mean, what you come up with is so unusable. It's like one woman with horseback riding and she had ADHD and let's write a research article. I can't use that in the school.
Yeah.
So it was really missing. So I had to go outside of the OT field. And I think Russell Barkley, you start there. I think everybody starts there. He's like the king of ADHD research and he just retired. And I've read everything of his, and then it just keeps going. it was like a rabbit hole that I went down and just have never come out of. And it's been many years. But
right. I mean, your most recent Instagram post as of today is a picture of a bunch of books from the conference you just attended. So obviously nothing has changed in regarding to your reading habits.
Yep. And I only did that because I did the same picture the year before. So I'm like, that's going to be my leaving picture every year is the stack of books on the hotel bed because they didn't fit in my suitcase. That was the problem. I had last year, not this last one, but the one before, I had to leave. I usually travel with a pillow. I had to leave my pillow behind to get the books home because I had so many and I had a carry on.
That is funny. That's good.
This year I left space.
Gosh. All right. So someone found a pillow in your hotel room. All right. Well, now, as you mentioned, right, ADHD and OT, we know that we can support students with ADHD, but as you mentioned, there's not a lot of resources out there. However, you are kind of taking on that role right now with your Instagram, with your website. And so I'm excited to dive into that. But I want to ask you, you know, you had students, you started to see more students with ADHD, but was there one specific moment that just like dawned on you, hey, I need to do this. I need to be the one to create these resources for the students, for the teachers, and for other occupational therapy practitioners?
Oh, yes. It was one very specific moment. Well, I had already been studying it. It was just on my own and I was just applying it with my own students. It wasn't, you know, I was a lone occupational therapist like many of us are. I just work with myself, you know, my speech therapist is my buddy and I just do my job. And I was at a CSE meeting for one of my students, one of my very favorites, but they're all my favorites, but this one I just, And we're at the CSE meeting and the teacher is we're talking about handwriting because the handwriting, it just sticks. And, you know, this child was in he was in third grade. And the teacher, we were talking about the gains he's made. And she says, well, he can write neatly when he tries. And I actually lost it at this point. I had learned so much that it became dangerous. I had too much knowledge. And I lost it and I've never 22 years. Like I have never lost it at a CSE meeting. I behave and I snapped and it wasn't even because she said, and I just started lecturing. I didn't do anything really crazy. I just, you know, was lecturing and like without knowing your audience and the parents were there lecturing, but it wasn't because she said he can try harder. I got used to dealing with that every day. It was that she was a brand new special ed teacher, brand new. That just came out of school. And I went home and I emailed and apologized. And then I opened a website. First, I Googled how to open a website. Then I opened a website because I said, I am going to just tell all the teachers. Like, I have 44 teachers in my school. Like, what, you know, that's not even going to help. And look, my 44, and this one's just someone has to tell these teachers, like, they need this information. They don't know. And I just started just putting, I opened up an Instagram. I made it OT for ADHD. I mean, there's no creativity, you could tell in that moment. I was just like, what could it be called? OT for ADHD. Good. The F-O-R was taken. So I just used the number 4. Like, this was all done in a moment. And I just started posting like one a day and just things, anything that I just thought people should know. And from there, I just keep doing it every day. I'm shocked that I kept it going, but people were really grateful for the information. And I was dripping it in bite-sized pieces, like a piece, just one little piece of information rather than these giant books that I was reading. So it really, it came out of anger, which so many wonderful things do, but that's how I started it.
Yeah, I love it. I mean, as I kind of scroll through your Instagram, right, you have like tip number one or tip for this, and it's just a very nice bite-sized piece of information that you can take, kind of put it into your heart, maybe create a little mantra about it if you need to, but it's something that you can start to implement very quickly. So I love that. I think we have all been in an IEP meeting or a CSC meeting where someone has said that, right? Like, oh, he can write his name when he wants to. He can write when he wants to. He can behave when he wants to. He can whatever when he wants to. And I know every OT practitioner dies a little inside when we hear that, because we know, like, we understand where that person's coming from, whether it's a teacher, a parent, even another OT practitioner. But we also understand, using a holistic lens, how almost inappropriate it sounds. It's almost like a 4-letter word for us, right? Like, that's just hard for us to hear. And so, as you mentioned, you've heard that countless times. And so I'd love for you to kind of take us into the moment. Like, how does that really make you feel? And what are you hearing when someone says that?
Well, kids do well when they can. So, I mean, I think we all know Ross Green, and kids do well when they can. These students are just so misunderstood, and they want to do well, and they don't even know how to do well. They don't know why they're not doing well. And I hear it from preschool teachers. There is not a preschooler in the world that doesn't want to do everything well. I mean, it's like, I do it. That's what preschoolers say. Let me do it.
Right.
So, It just, the fact that it's mistaken for a will-based condition is actually the most damaging thing. That is what creates the secondary complications with ADHD. And that is what really, I think, fuels my passion for it, because there are so many things out in the world that OTs help people participate and perform and that we don't have control over. You know, if someone has hemiplegic arm, I can help them, but I can't prevent more damage from their arm. But with ADHD, the humans in the context of this child's life actually have the power to prevent just by their own beliefs. And it is really just, we have more power in the schools and more control. And I say we, I mean teachers, over the outcomes than we even know. So if we knew, we would all do better. Because I did have one post that said, teachers do well when they can. They don't
Love
know.
That. Yep.
They don't. And when they find out, they're like, huh, I see what you mean now. But it takes a little while. But once they know, then they know.
Awesome.
And
yeah,
it makes it changes the entire prognosis for the child.
Yeah, I love that.
That's a lot of power.
Yeah. And we're going to get into a little bit more about strategies here in maybe 20 minutes or so. But I kind of want to dive into those challenges of what we see, what teachers see. And I don't want to overgeneralize. I know every student with ADHD is different from every other student with ADHD. But I'd like to ask you, what are some of the common functional difficulties that you see students with ADHD having as it relates to, you know, progressing and participating in education
in school? Well, it's very prevalent. So you're looking at about 1 in 10. So that's 2 to 3 in every single class. And ADHD is extremely heterogeneous. I mean, extremely. You can have two kids sitting next to each other and they appear to have an incredibly opposite profile and they both have ADHD. And comorbidities or co-occurring conditions with ADHD change the whole picture. So you have a boy with primarily impulsive presentation, ADHD, and dyslexia is going to have way different challenges than a girl that's also twice exceptional and has ADHD and is just inattentive. They look totally different, but it's the same thing. So the challenges are really all over the mark. But what ADHD really is a neurodevelopmental difference of self-regulation and executive function. So it touches everything in school, and executive functions develop throughout, you know, the entire school. They don't fully develop into your mid-20s. And there's a great variance with executive functions to begin with. So little kids with ADHD are the kids that a lot of OTs are approached about. They look like they have sensory problems. They have self-regulation problems. Their transitions are the worst possible thing. They're melting down, emotional dysregulation. You're seeing that in the younger grades. And then hyperactivity for children who are hyperactive. You'll see that, and you know, they can't stay seated. And then you see a ton of internal distraction and rumination and more of that emotional anxiety dysregulation. And then as they get older, the hyperactivity decreases in adolescence. And there's like a studies of this, the progression, and it kind of goes inside. So then it's more in your head. And then you're seeing the disorganization, the difficulty with time. Then they're talking more about that, the teachers. So it really depends on the age and stage and what else, what other conditions are present as far as their challenges. But it's all over the map. And the children who do not have the hyperactivity piece are the ones you really do have to worry about.
Why is that?
Because they're not being identified. The stereotypical bouncing first grade boy that's always got an October birthday and he's a lefty. I don't know why, but it's just always that profile that should be a study. That guy gets help. That guy, you know, the teacher is like, what is going on? You know, he's hanging from the ceiling. He gets help. But the one that is in the corner, and it doesn't have to be a girl. A lot of females have that are late diagnosed adults, you know, were quiet. They are not a problem. You're teaching a class of 20 to 30 kids. The quiet kid is not your problem. Like, you're not even paying attention. And they're struggling. And no one knows they're struggling. And that that becomes anxiety and depression later on, the untreated piece. So we really need to be very careful when we're looking at children that are struggling and disorganized and forgetting things and having that very inattentive presentation, but that aren't a problem, and then are having emotional problems. They really need to be looking at what's going on with these kids.
Gotcha. Great. Thank you for sharing that. Based upon kind of your response, I have two follow-ups here. Take them one at a time. You started with that very first kid that really got you going. You mentioned how people were saying, oh, he can write when he wants to. Obviously, ADHD is not a motor disability, right? However, I think we have all experienced kids with ADHD who struggle with writing. You mentioned a little bit about self-regulation, emotional regulation when it comes to ADHD, executive functioning. Where's the connect between ADHD and handwriting? Why is it that you see students who have poor handwriting have ADHD?
So the connect between ADHD and handwriting, which is like super fascinating, and you'll jump right into the rabbit hole with me, is working memory. It's working memory. And it's huge. So the entire writing process is governed by working memory. There's a triangle. Picture the triangle between transcription, which is handwriting and spelling, and then written expression, like where you're taking all your thoughts and you're making an essay out of it.
Yeah,
all sentences, of these
everything.
Sentences, everything. It all plays on that working memory. You have to be able to hold things in mind before you can transfer them to long-term schemas, graphemes, phonemes, all that. It's called orthographic, organization. It's so that working memory governs writing. It governs handwriting. It governs learning the letters. And then it governs being able to write words and sentences. And working memory is indicated as being one of the things that the developmental difference in the prefrontal cortex impacts. So the reason why children with ADHD have difficulty with handwriting may be the motor piece, but it's really that we do a really good job at helping with that as therapists. That's what I was seeing. I was like, oh, motor skills are fine with letters in isolation. As soon as you have to put those letters together and start moving across the page, they're gone. And I was like, it's a sequencing thing. No, it's a working memory thing. And working memory is limited in the neurotypical adult to 3 to 4 pieces of information at a time. It's not very big.
Yeah.
Typically in a student with ADHD, it's like one piece of information at a time, one step, then give them the next step. And it's most of the help is compensatory in nature. So when they're saying he needs to try harder, I'm like, nope, he doesn't need to try harder. He needs to try differently because that's not going to work for him. And that is, it's a huge wow moment for teachers. They really do understand that working memory piece. And if you're like a research person, Berninger, she's the best. She has all the working memory.
Just have that off the top of your head, you know, working memory. Berninger.
I do actually have that off the top of my head.
I love it. No, you know, that resonates with me. I've sat in so many IEPs where I try and break that down for parents and teachers, right? I don't think I've ever actually said the words working memory, but kind of like you said, right? Like you use the word sequencing or something like that. And you try to help parents and teachers understand that writing is so much more than just putting letters on a page. And as you mentioned, we can hold 3, 4, maybe 5 things in our brain at a time, kids much less. And when you really break down the tasks of writing, if you don't know how to spell the word the, T-H-E, you don't know how to put it on paper. Before that, every single letter is like 18 steps from the brain to the pencil to the paper. And we sometimes have to help parents to understand that and teachers to understand that, which is, it's hard, but it's something that we sometimes need to speak up in an IEP and tell them about.
Yes. And if they haven't automated, so if they automate their writing, if they automate letter formation, which typically they're supposed to by third grade, automate those letter formations. So then they can use them to learn. You know, you're not learning to read and write, you're writing, reading and writing to learn. So if they're not automated, each one of those letters are an actual task. So you could have 2 or 3 and then you're done, you're overloaded. And once your working memory is overloaded, nothing else is getting in. I in one of the posts, I made it like a iPhone battery. Like when it's iPhone memory, when it's full, it's full. Nothing else is getting in. So when you overload that working memory with non-automated tasks, the other things aren't getting in. You're not ignoring them. You're not listening. They're just not getting in. And it's like when you walk into a room and you're like, why did I come in this room? Like that's gone. Whatever the reason was, it's gone because it never got in. So you go back to where you came from and you look around and then that same thing will re-spark what it was that you went into the other room for. So that's why with the writing. And it's great. Go.
Sorry, Lori. As soon as you started talking about the iPhone memory, my brain went to, I keep getting emails from Apple saying I have 10% left in my iCloud storage. And my brain was full at that point. But no, really, though, let's continue on. So we talked a little bit about that handwriting, that motor piece, and working memory being such a big part of handwriting. I think that's important, right? Because we've all been in a conversation where people, whether it's an OT, a teacher, someone else, thinks like all OTs do is motor and sensory, but working memory is definitely something that we can touch on. And we'll come back to that in a moment. But I do want to ask that other question that I had was about sensory. Is there a sensory component to ADHD? You talked about self-regulation, executive functioning, but you did mention that sometimes someone might approach you thinking it's a sensory difficulty, sensory processing difficulty. So is there a tie? Is there not a tie? Talk to me.
So children with sensory processing difficulties and ADHD, there is a huge overlap. They can have both, but ADHD is a developmental difference in the prefrontal cortex of the brain. Sensory processing is not the same. When we use sensory integration, that doesn't help ADHD, but you are going to have lots of people with ADHD that also have difficulty processing, you know, sensations. And they're also highly sensitive. They have poor, selective attention skills. So they're taking in a ton of input and then having difficulty regulating the input. So it is, everything is sensory. Everything is behavior.
Yeah.
You know, so it's very hard, but you can't say, oh, I'm going to put him, you know, in an SI gym and that's going to help his ADHD, because it will not help his ADHD. But when I go into a classroom and the child's highly distracted and I give them sound blocking headphones, that's technically a sensory intervention, but I'm giving it to that child to block distractions for, so it's for a different reason, or a cushion, because when students with ADHD sit on the move and sit cushions, they get to move and they do better when they can move, but it's not because he's sensory seeking. It's because he has ADHD. So sensory is almost a symptom of, you know, a side effect of ADHD, but they have to be distinguished, because there are studies out there that say occupational therapy does not work for ADHD in the schools. I actually wrote to the person that did the study because it was so inflammatory. And it was, they gave the student weighted vests and the therapy ball, right? Those were the two interventions that they did a research study on. And that was it. And then they called those two OT. Pieces of equipment without any training. They just kind of like gave these kids they called that OT. That's not OT.
Familiar.
Yeah, it was an FIU study. I was really mad about the study, and it was wrong to do that. So we have to be careful. Like, this is why I am using this. So, and they do, they're extremely, you know, co-occurring, especially sound sensitivity. I see that quite often. But the reason for using equipment or for taking a break, it's not a break because he's sensory seeking. It's a break because he needs to reset his executive functions and change environments so he can re-engage. Mm-hmm. So it's the same but different, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I kind of want to almost, for the rest of the podcast, honestly, I think we might kind of go about it as a case study per se. And I want to start with that in the sense that if you receive a referral for a student who's maybe having some difficulties with handwriting, maybe some behavioral concerns, no real diagnosis, and you think that, you know, ADHD may or may not be a factor, does that manifest within your evaluation? Does your evaluation look a little different? Or I guess, like, what are you looking for in your evaluation, and how do you look for that information?
So my evaluation has changed greatly, not even because of this research, just because of the new direction of OT. Mm-hmm. My evaluation is very functional based now. I could care less what the bot says. Like, that really has no part of what I'm doing in the school. A little part. Like, I do kind of curious, but that's about it. I look at what it is, what the problem is in the classroom. What is the expectation? What is the procedure? Procedures are everything in a school. And if you look, there's 40 of them, right? 40 procedures these kids have to know in a classroom. Like, they have a procedure for sharpening a pencil, for coming in. There's just procedure. That's how they run. You have to have them.
Yeah.
That's how good classrooms run, on their procedures. And which ones are a difficulty? And then I go back to why. And I look at the student, you know, developmentally. I do the occupational profile. I look at executive functions, because there's no getting around them. They're in everything. Mm-hmm. And I could use, depending on the age, I could use a standardized test. I use informal. I use interview. And then I look at what it is that I see clinically, which I've been doing this a long time, so it's kind of unfair compared to someone brand new. But clinically, I can see, all right, this child might be having difficulty with, let's say, visual processing or fine motor or sensory or executive function. And then I would go a little deeper to try to uncover there. And then the ADHD piece is usually pretty obvious to me, only because 70% of my caseload has ADHD. So starting to be like, okay, yeah. To the point where I'm like, why is everyone having, like, it just has become like what I do, but it is it's a 70%. It's 80% of children with ADHD have another condition. It's rare for someone to just have ADHD all by itself. So they're on my caseload, maybe because they had difficulty with fine motor development. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm working on that with them, or developmental coordination disorder. That's a big one that likes to go hand in hand. And those two together make the motor skills are very difficult for these kids, really difficult. And then I go from there, and I'm all about, let's get them doing it. Get them doing it. I'm strength-based, you know, let's get them doing it in a way that works best for them, because this is lifelong. And the American Academy of Pediatrics, the chronic care model is not, you know, let me spend the next 6 years of my life working on these fine motor skills. I am changing the occupation. I'm changing the task. I'm matching the child to the expectation, and I'm saving their self-esteem. And I think that's what OTs are supposed to be doing in the schools, but we forget. Especially me, who was trained with performance components. Like, it was, you know, back in the black and white days, it was a long time ago. And I would go in and say, okay, what are the performance? What are the breakdowns? What are the weaknesses? Let me fix them. But it won't generalize because of working memory. And it needs to be in the classroom, and you need to match the kid. So it does. I totally went off task there, but it does.
No,
it really,
you're totally fine. And I want to challenge you here then, because you put some emphasis on working memory. And as you know, not everyone listening has the 22 years of experience as you do. And the bot doesn't give you working memory. The SPM doesn't give you working memory. So if I may, maybe one or two things that you kind of do specifically to look at working memory.
All right. So even more interesting, observation in the natural environment. So have you ever had the child that you take them to your room to evaluate them? And they do amazing. I mean, they're all of the standardized testing is like off the charts. And we're like, I saw this child function in the classroom with my own two eyes, but on paper, this is a superstar. That is what we're dealing with ADHD, because your context in the novelty of the one-to-one environment sparked everything, and they are running at their tippity top best, and they are remembering, they are answering questions. They can do everything on all of your tests. But then you put them in the classroom and it's gone because they're overloaded and they can't perform in that context. So you get more from your observation, and you get more from when it comes to executive functions, because you can't really test them outside of the natural environment because you're in a different environment. So that right there, the demands and expectations are totally different. Yeah. Would be like the brief is a standardized test that you could email the teacher. For some reason, I get those back like instant. Sometimes you have to chase teachers down for, you know, for checklists. This one, I guess it's just such a friendly format to fill it out. I mean, boom, it's never been even a day. They give them right back. Par eConnect has it like where it's like a Q Global type thing. So the brief works great, and it will give you different scales about the working memory.
Okay.
And I steal from the school psychologist from the WISC, and I spend more time. I think I read his report more than he does. Like, I really study it.
I love having the psych reports. Oh yeah. Psych reports available.
I'm at the point where I'm like, I'm not testing them till the psych report's done, because it gives me so much information as to where the strengths are, and you're always going to see the working memory is low, cognitive proficiency is low, processing speed may be low, the coding, that's all that piece there. So when you see that on the psych report, it's a piece to the puzzle.
Can you say that one more time, you know, for everyone?
The WISC 5, there's actually studies. I'm such a visual person. Like, I'm actually looking at the picture of it in my head, and I want to show it to you, and I keep forgetting we're sound. In the WISC 5, you're going to see lower scores in coding, processing speed, which is the cognitive proficiency area of the WISC, and the working memory. You're going to see those lower than everything else. So the child might be like in the, most of my students, I actually charted them like 99th percentile in the whole thing. And then they'll be in the 40th.
Oh, wow.
So in that, which nobody would say that's a disability, but it's, there's a little glitch in the subtest. I'm like, yep. Oh, that's not a glitch. That is exactly what we're seeing in the classroom. And it's that cognitive proficiency. They're not able to apply their intelligence in the moment. And it's very interesting. And they actually, the WISC-5 takes out those, the coding, the working memory, the processing speed to get, I don't want to say it's crystallized intelligence. There's another word for it, to get a different intelligence score that's usually higher because it brought that down, and they'll use that for students that have ADHD.
Interesting.
Yeah. Huh.
Good to know. Yeah. Learn something new. All right.
Those type reports.
Right. All right. So now if you've done your evaluation, you've started to, tease out some of these items. Before we get into the intervention side, I actually want to ask you about the IEP or the CSC meeting itself. Everyone should know, if we've worked in the schools for, 6 months or longer, we can't go into an IEP and say, hey, your student has ADHD, right? So how do you present to a parent, especially if it's a student who hasn't been identified as ADHD, how do you kind of present that to them and say, these are the types of things that we want to work on because can't use ADHD? So how do you word that?
I would never say to a parent, it's wrong of me. My school psychologist can do that all he wants, but they'll give him the Connors if that's a concern. And they'll take the Connors, which is a ADHD screening, to the pediatrician.
Okay.
Because nobody in the school would diagnose someone with ADHD, but they would say, we are concerned with his ability to attend, do this, that, the other thing. He's inattentive. We're showing all this. Mm-hmm. You may want to bring this to your pediatrician, but to be totally honest, I don't even care if they have an ADHD diagnosis. It does not change anything I'm going to do for that child, because whether or not they're identified, which I do believe it's very important to be identified with that, even just to know, it does put a name to what's going on, depending on the age and for the parent. I'm going to work on whatever the thing is in the school they're having difficulty performing, whether or not they have ADHD. It just lets me know that I'm going to have to use a little bit of a different type of intervention. So I'm still working on the same goals. Mm-hmm. I just know that I am going to work in the classroom rather than out of the classroom. I need to be at the point of performance. I need to have much more teacher and parent buy-in than I would. And I need to be looking at a strength-based, very protective, very lifelong, build my own skills type practice, rather than like, let's, play these games, makes our finger muscles stronger and go. And I need to know that when they're little, I am going to automate those writing skills like you've never seen. I'm going to really focus on automation more than anything, because I want that off their plate. I want it automated. Mm-hmm. There's a lot to know as an OT. So it's not that I'm going out there and treating all the kids with ADHD. I actually don't treat ADHD. I treat a student so they can participate and perform in their school environment, whether they have ADHD, dyslexia, lefties with October birthdays, they're all, it doesn't matter. It does in the fact that I have branched out more and I help train parents and teachers, but that's the only way it really matters. Otherwise, it just trains the way I approach my intervention because I have more information then.
Yeah. Great. I love that. That's a
mind blowing.
Yeah. It's something that, again, if we've been in the schools for more than a few weeks, then you've been told by someone like, OTs do not make diagnoses. We don't make diagnoses even outside, right, of the schools. But we have to be very careful not to make diagnoses. We also have to be sometimes very mindful of not making a referral, right? Like, we can't say, hey, there's an OT that specializes in ADHD on 1st and A Street. Yeah. Go check them out. We have to be careful about that as well. So, yeah, thanks for sharing a little bit about that.
Yes.
Now, let's move on to that next piece, right? So you have this data, you've talked to the IEP team about needing to provide some supports. There's many routes that we could go from here, right? You talked about how you're going to treat differently based upon your information. what are some things that you might consider? Let's just dive into considerations, not what you would do, but what are you going to consider as you develop your service model type of plan?
So I'm at the IEP meeting for this new student.
Yeah.
Right. So I would be the accommodations become, I hate to even, do you ever be at the, you're at the initial CSE meeting and everyone's gone over their reports, right? And it's always running very long when every single person's going over an initial. And then you get to the end and they're like, any accommodations? And they seem, I don't know, it always just seems like an afterthought, like, or it did until I started reading all this. Like any, especially for the younger kids that don't have testing, really. Any accommodations, people throw out preferential seating, refocus, redirect. That's where I go, whoa, let's go back because we need to make this environment match this child. So most of what I do in a CSE meeting is get really crystal clear on accommodations and how exactly they're implemented. And in New York, we have like this box for management needs. And that thing is, it is like bulleted down half a page for me rather than it would, it just would be like, Sally has poor fine motor skills. She needs help. Like, it's not like that anymore. I'm like, because this is what is going to help this child. So that's the big difference, I would say, in the CSE thing. Is I put a lot of, I'm very mindful about the accommodations, but more so about the implementation guidance. Because what does refocus and redirect mean? What does preferential seating mean? People actually think it means they get to pick their seat. Like, that is, you better know that's not what that means.
I'm going on because I love where you're about to go, because I do the same thing. I may not have half a page of accommodations, but for any accommodation that I am going to put onto that page, I'm going to make sure that there's a plan to actually incorporate that accommodation. Yes. Because too often you put an accommodation onto a page and then a year later you come back for the IEP team meeting and someone asks, how has this been accommodated? How has this been implemented? And everyone looks at each other like, did you do it? Did you do it? Who's the one who taught him how to use speech to text? Who's the one who taught him how to use that feature on the test, right? So what do you do then?
So I don't do a half a page accommodations. I keep my accommodations small. And they really, I have data to prove everyone, because we have to remember, these are a big ask of teachers' accommodations. And I basically am with the younger kids where it's one classroom teacher in their class. But if you think of middle school, high school, they have hundreds of students with hundreds of accommodations. So you have to be very careful. It's the implementation guidance, like you're saying, the plan, that is a half page. Like, gotcha. You know exactly, if I put an accommodation on an IEP, you know how to provide that accommodation. There is no question. You're not wondering where that this child should sit in the classroom. You know what, where, and you know why. You know exactly why. And I think that's super important, because when you know why, you're going to do it.
More likely to do it, yeah.
Yes. And then the child is going to accept it, because kids hate being othered. So accommodations really are a very important thing that get very, you know, swept over. And that's... And I also, now most, I don't know, OT has to go and do this. This is my own craziness, but I work in one small district. So I know who the teacher is. There's only two. There's a choice. It's a 50-50 shot for next year. So I know who the teacher is, and I write out a cheat sheet for each one of my students all their accommodations and like ways. And I do it like at the CSE meeting, like as we're talking, like what's working for this student now. And being that I know that teacher and I know how they teach, and my kid just had that teacher. Yeah. I know exactly what they do. And I think this is because I'm in a small space. Mm-hmm. I give them a IEP cheat sheet, I call it, or the 504 cheat sheet before school starts. That has made, I tell parents to do that for their own children, because it has made such a difference to have it just bulleted. This works, this works, this works. This is what I mean. This happens when you do this. This is great. And the teachers, it really does help open collaboration with them, because they're like, oh, thank you. You know, I have 40 IEPs to read. Like, this was so nice. I could just, I still have to read the IEP legally, but like I can apply it immediately. Mm-hmm. So that helps.
I have a question then, because I've considered this. I don't think I've ever actually done it. But basically, to create an IEP goal for an accommodation to be implemented. Now, I don't think I've done it that specific. I think I have done some like self-advocacy goals, right? Where the student will access accommodations on the IEP or something like that, but nothing specific to an accommodation. Is that something that you might do? Or because you're doing this cheat sheet for teachers, you haven't needed to do it?
I've written, if you're going to use an accommodation like speech to text, I really do hope you have a goal matching that one, because you need, the child needs to know how to use speech to text with a certain level of fidelity for it to be, you know, anything even close to helpful. So there, I will always have a goal, and that I will put the accommodations that the child has access to speech to text, not that they have to use it, because that means they have to use it. You have to be very, it's a legal document. So have access to, and then they will be trained as a goal, and they can use it when they have a certain fidelity at home, school. But I have never, outside of the self-advocacy, I've written a goal that was like the child will choose from a visual choice board, like, you know, three out of three, like where to take a break and the accommodation a break, like that type of tying together the goal and the accommodation. But I've never been so specific, like the child will tolerate their accommodations and use them. But, you know, self-advocacy, and that's so important. But I do have a funny, I do have a funny 504 story. So I had been working really hard on self-advocacy with a certain student, and they kind of took it too far. Like they really owned their 504. Like this was like their cape. And I was happy, you know, they're using their 504 and they're always talking about their 504, and they got in trouble. The kid was at a sleepover and got in trouble. And the one kid got his phone taken away, but the other child, you know, supposedly nothing happened to him, you know, because he had a 504. So he didn't get in trouble with his parents.
Wow.
That's what they said. That's what the kid said.
Over.
Yeah. He said, well, he didn't get grounded because he has a 504. I was like, whoa, you guys have taken the 504 way too far. So, you know, ADHD is not your fault, right? It's your responsibility. And 504s are not about what you can't do. They're about what you can do and how you can do it. So it took I learned that the hard way. I'll never forget that.
You know, and if I recall, you only have to live by the 504 rules if you're getting federal funding. So where are those parents' federal funding? I want some of that federal funding if I'm right. No. All right. Cool. So we talked a little bit about accommodations. I kind of also want to talk to you about environmental factors and maybe some things that you might consider aside from the accommodations, just general environmental adaptations that you may recommend to a teacher potentially.
So the first and foremost best environmental factor in a classroom, there's a couple. All right. So a visual schedule. A visual schedule is like a magical wand of help for just everybody. If I can go into the classroom and I can walk into a classroom and I know what I'm supposed to be doing right now at this moment without talking to anyone. I can look around and know that the child's going to really thrive in that classroom, because this teacher has a very structured classroom teaching. You have a visual schedule. You know what's coming up next. You know what you're supposed to be doing now. And I love the ones that use the slideshows, like agendas, like, you know, it's math you need. And then you do it once and you have it for the rest of your life. You just have this thing going. That is an amazing environment. But these students do very well in structured, explicit environments. Flexible seating is dreamy, but they can function without flexible seating, but I don't think they can function without the visual schedule. If a child has difficulty holding things in mind and everything is being told to them verbally, these children really, really struggle with that. And that's all. They may be the most brilliant child you have in the room. And you said, put my name. And then you said, put my last name. And they only put their first name. Like all that verbiage isn't getting through. So to have things externalized essentially steps to all the procedures and routines, mm-hmm. that is where we're going to see it, it's, I call them visual schedules, but the visual schedule of where you now, later, what I need. And it's just always visible. So if you get distracted, you come back, you know where you are.
Gotcha. So making it easy for the child to find what they're supposed to be doing in the moment.
Yeah. And what's okay. coming next? What's coming next takes a lot of the anxiety away.
When you're saying visual schedule, I think of like literal pictures. Do you think it needs to be to that extent, or depending on the grade, can it be just like a, you know, words and like what, how do you sort that out? Or do you prefer one or the other?
I prefer the pictures for a couple of reasons. The pictures give us a visual image of what done looks like. So that's very hard to imagine if you're having difficulty holding things in mind. Like, what does done look like? So when you have the pictures, you're able to almost, children with ADHD have difficulty with episodic memory and future thinking because of that working memory. So it's hard for them to picture anything besides now. Everything is now. It's now or not now. That's where they're living. So giving them the actual vision of the future, which is like the done product, what's next, mm-hmm. in the picture form really, really helps. It scaffolds learning.
Yeah.
Do I want like the little peck icon of like, you know, math with the little numbers? No. You know, but a picture of the math book that they're supposed to yeah. have would be amazing because yeah. now they're going to build that visual memory.
Yeah. Of and, that and let's book. Be honest. Canva and many other tools make it way too easy now to have to rely on specific programs.
And I could use video. Canva is like the best thing ever. Yeah. I'm obsessed.
And educators, free account. All you have to use yep. is your work ID or your work email, and you should get a free Canva, like the full thing, not the mini Canva, the full Canva software. So yeah, absolutely a great tool.
A picture of the desk. Clean your desk, right? Mm-hmm. Clean. It's time to clean desks is one thing in words. And let's talk third grade. We can read, we know clean mm-hmm. desks. Mm-hmm. But if you have a picture of what a clean desk looks like, you have solved the world's problems there because you're helping so many kids like, oh, stack the books there like that. It's just, we're not all aware of how many steps a clean desk really is, even though most teachers think that's a step. So and having that definition. Up with the picture. Exactly.
Because who defines what does what a done clean look desk like? Is. Yeah. Yeah. So
yes, very it's cool. very different.
Yeah. All right. So I think you said that there might have been another environmental factor that you really like to look into. You talked about the visual schedules. You're kind of on the fence. It sounded like you might have more than one. So I wanted to see if there was one more that you wanted to talk about in relationship to the environment, setting up the environment for success.
Setting up the environment was well, it's really more in the human context. It's the understanding piece. So it doesn't, the environment, we need to expect that a child with ADHD is going, and it's impulsive, is going to be impulsive. So when they come in, we are anticipating impulsivity and we're anticipating the roadblocks and we're anticipating and setting up the environment with friction, you know, using it to and from. They talk about choice architecture, right? Like it's a consumer thing where they put, you know, the grocery store has all like the junk food on the outer aisle, the mm-hmm. inner aisles. It's that you could do that with the classroom. It's the same thing. You want to nudge children to make the right decisions. You don't want to have cupcakes sitting on the counter next to an impulsive child and then expect them not to eat the cupcakes. Like that, come on, like, but that type of stuff, just pointing it out, like, let's, you know, put them here, put that here and nudge them and decrease the overload. So I always say like the plan B is the roadblocks. When you look as the adult in charge of that child and you look around for those you're expecting, mm-hmm. you really do set them up with success. So that's the big one is the just structured environment that is, you know, has, I call choice architecture. Like it is nudging the kids. Like they don't have, you don't put their supplies across the room. Mm-hmm. you put those supplies right at the desk. If they're going to get a pencil, they are not coming back. Like you cannot, like the pencils are sharpened and ready to go. Like, and that you're going to save that lesson just by having those pencils there. Do not allow that unsharpened pencil. No, you're losing them that period. Like that type of thinking process. And you need to have that by accepting, yep. You know, I accept this student is going to be distractive. I am ready. Let's do this.
We've all seen that kid that takes 15 minutes to sharpen a pencil. Like, yeah, yeah.
Or the absolutely. Bathroom trip.
Oh, yeah.
My OT room is near the bathroom. The OT room is near the bathroom. And I, you know, it's fun looking and I'm fun. And the kids come wandering in and I'm like, where are you supposed to be?
Yeah.
In the bathroom.
Yep. Oh, man.
Just jump for a minute.
Yeah. All right. So we've covered some accommodations, some environmental aspects, structuredness of the classroom. Now let's talk about the actual services. You dropped a few hints in regards to some things that you might key in on in regards to providing services for your students who have ADHD or are struggling with some executive function and whatnot. But what are some things that you're going to consider very important when it comes time to choosing the type of services you're providing?
Okay. So depending on all the different factors, yeah. Right? So they're having difficulty. So again, I don't treat any type of diagnosis, right? Yeah. I treat the student as having difficulty with, let's say he's having difficulty with written expression and organization, which is like what everyone's having difficulty with mm-hmm. that I treat. So sure. I could work on written expression and organization in my room, but that is not going to help them in the classroom with 25 other kids. They're going to be very well organized in my tiny room with just me, and they're going to be very well written in that extremely individualized novel, like totally speaking to their special interest writing prompt I give them. It's going to be the best thing ever because I know how to, you know, get the engagement. So you really need to be pushing in, which I know is so hard, but working with the student at the point of performance, anything outside that point of performance is not going to stay. They need help in the now. Because time is now or not now, they need the help mm-hmm. now and they need it in the natural environment. So a lot of my sessions, I've learned this hack is that I put it, this all depends on your school and your IEP coordinator, what they change like daily. So I put like one in one out on the
IEP services.
On the IEP.
Right? I do that too.
But I used to just put various locations. And then
no,
because they don't want that anymore because of the torque. So now I do one in, one out. And because there are some things I still need to go back and skill build a little bit yep. that I can't do in the classroom with everybody else.
Yeah.
And so that one in, one out really, really helps me. Or there's the 3-to-1 model, like the 3 times a month.
Yeah. 3 times
in,
and then
one out.
Yeah. The one in, one out that you're talking about. I call it 2-to-2 because I think of in a month. So I call it the 2-to-2 model, kind of like the 3-to-1 model is in a month. I call it 2-to-2, one in, one out, one in, one out, kind of going back and forth.
Yeah.
But yeah, I like that model a lot.
Yeah. And if you need to be in more, you're okay. You don't have to go out because it's least mm-hmm. restrictive. And I always put group because I do want them to do things with other people. But if we need to work on something privately, we could be individual. And then once a month teacher consult time that I won't there. That's on the IEP for every one of my kids because I'm done. I need the time to talk to the teacher. And I can make the time by doing that. The teachers can't. So if I don't put it there, we're not talking. It's very interesting.
Lori, you just became my best friend. I love that. No, I completely advocate for that as well. Having that extra consult on there, because if it's not on there, then really it's not required. And if it's not required, it's not going to happen. Yeah.
And I've gotten subs for my teachers so they can consult with me.
Oh, wow.
That's how you make best friends with a teacher. Yeah. Like I'm not going to take them. Probably want to get them a sub. Can I have a sub for this period? We need to really work together on this. Of course. And someone gives them a sub and then it's not taking away. There's little strategies.
That's awesome.
You're there to help them. That's our job. We are their support.
Yep.
We're support.
Yeah. And again, if you don't put that on the IEP, it might be that much more difficult to get a sub. I mean, it's hard to get a sub in general, but at least if you've got consult on your IEP and you can tell your administrator, hey, I've got 8 kids that I need to consult with this teacher for, then then you can justify potentially that sub time.
Yeah. And we have, I mean, and a lot of schools have really, I'm going to say that in the past 5 years, I've seen a movement to more of the collaborative team model, just in even just my tiny school, like where we have like bi-weekly team meetings for like a classroom that has a lot of students with speech OT needs, PT needs, and we all meet as a team. And that's, talk about it. That's like a game changer. It really puts everyone on the same page. And it's really amazing. So the more we see that, I think the more it's going to be, well, of course you need consult time with a teacher. Like it would be ridiculous not to have it, where it was like, what, why do you need that? Like, what do you mean?
Yeah.
And you know, I've worked where I never spoke to the teacher until the annual review. And then I would leave the annual review and go, wow, I didn't know that about so-and-so. I wish I would have talked to this teacher sooner. Do that a couple of times and you learn how important it is. But it's hard to advocate in the system, but it really is a great model. And it's once a month. So if you have multiple kids, you just put in 2 slots into your schedule and you wind up being able to see all the teachers like on a revolving basis.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. All right. Let's take maybe Lori's time back a few years before her schools weren't so collaborative and you weren't meeting with the teachers all the time and you were just starting to push into the classrooms. That's hard, right? For those who are not yet pushing into the classroom, do you have just 1 or 2 tips to kind of get started with that to make it a little bit easier to start having a productive session in a classroom?
So teach the whole class.
There you go.
That's you go in, you teach the whole class, you do something fun, and the kids like you. You get the buy-in of the teacher in that moment. You're doing stuff for the teacher. You're helping the teacher. Mm-hmm. I have walked into a push-in where they were reading a story and I stood and watched, you know, the teacher read the kids a story, dying inside. Like, oh, I'm not, this is like, I can't, what this is wrong. Here? Why am I here? Yeah. Like this, but you know, things like that happen. Move that time, you know, to a better time if you can. Otherwise, then that's not someone you could be pushing in with. It doesn't work. Yeah. But if you could, so I would teach a handwriting lesson. I did like 10 weeks of kindergarten push-ins where I just do like fine motor stuff. And then I was kind of like, I'm helping my student, but everyone else around and giving the teacher tips. But when you build those relationships, they are begging you to come in next year. It's no longer a question about, is it push-in? They're like, well, what time is my OT push-in time? It's not. And it just helps. And you share. And I made a do not go on, right? Do not go on. It was like a blocker for a kid that was going ahead in his math. So I said, well, let's get something like very physical. It was a piece of paper laminated and they put it in like a bookmark. And when he got to the donut that said, do not go in, and it was full sheet, he knew to stop. And it said, you can, and gave him some choices of what else to do. I didn't make one. I made 25, laminated 25 of them and handed them to the teacher because everyone in the class used it because everyone in the class goes on. So it became, she still has it years later. She still uses it.
I love it.
And that's how you get like you're going to someone's home. Look at it that way. Like your mom.
Yeah.
Never go empty handed.
there you go. That's funny.
You're going to someone's home. You ask, you don't tell them, you know, you're not the expert in that classroom. You inspire, you don't instruct, and you teach the whole lesson and you have to develop a relationship like everywhere else. And it really does help with the push-in. It does not work when you walk in and say, I have to push in with this kid. This is the time I'm coming. Oh, no, you need to do this. Change this. Do that. It just, will not work.
Agreed. You reminded me of, you know, your stop sign paper. They use that for all types of things. Like, I remember taking a standardized test and you'd get to the end of the math section and there'd be a big page there, like, stop. So this isn't like it's something that is specific to working with a student with a disability. These are very common. I mean, maybe not common, but they're very usable strategies that work for all kids, not just for a student with a disability.
And a lot of things for ADHD are because we're all going to suffer from poor executive function some days. Because sleep deprivation, if you're sick, if you're drunk, you have no executive functions. So they actually have an app you could put on your phone so you don't drunk dial people. I mean,
what?
Yeah. Do a lot That's of ADHD funny. Research, you come across these things. So like they are blocking the impulsivity of a person who is intoxicated, therefore lost their inhibition, which is that executive mm-hmm. functioning skill. So they don't drunk dial their boss and lose their job in the morning.
That's
and
funny.
It's the same concept of what I'm doing. I'm helping someone with poor inhibition. So you mm-hmm. are going to see these things being very, you know, mainstreamy type, nothing so odd and othered to that help. That help a lot.
Yeah.
So yeah. often when they're given universally, they help a lot of kids because you're going to see difficulties with working memory and inhibition and emotional dysregulation with a lot of different things in the classroom. So it does work really well universally.
All right. Well, our time is going by very quick and we are kind of running out of time. So I have like two more questions that I really want to dive into. And for those listening who have kind of struggled with getting maybe the support from others on campus to support those with some of that executive functioning difficulties, self-regulation difficulties, they're really known as the handwriting specialist, the handwriting teacher, whatever it might be. What kind of tips might you have for them to kind of move on from just being the motor handwriting therapist?
Apply this knowledge to where you are. So you're innovating inside the box. So if you are working on handwriting with a student, and that is what others' expectations are of you, take a look at that handwriting from the lens of executive function. Take a look at the inhibition and the working memory and the cognitive flexibility that's needed in the, you know, any written output. And then share that information with the people around you and say, okay, I'm going to support this piece for that student's handwriting because of their ADHD. So you're innovating inside the box exactly where you are in your lane that people are expecting. So it's not this big, like you're breaking out and doing a new thing. Like you're still doing your thing, mm-hmm. but you're just doing it in a much more informed way. And that is, you build slowly from there because it will work. And people will be like, huh, now can we generalize that to something else? And then you slowly step up and away. Don't do anything radical. It doesn't work. So innovate inside the box. That's what I always say. Like, just stay where you are, but go up a step. If you don't communicate with your teachers, send them an email once in a while. Like, go up a step.
Yeah.
And I think that's really where you need to start. And then just share. I share a lot. And I ask, like, would you like me to send you some information about this? And if the teacher says, yeah, you send it to them, one page, never more than one page. It's not being read if it's more than one page, like literally one page.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you got to be careful.
It can't even be an attachment because attachments won't get open. It's just got to be right there in the email.
Yep. Yeah. And you have to go learn marketing. Like you have to have an attention grabber. Like, hey, teacher. But they're busy. And there's so many of these. You know, most teachers are awesome people. They're teachers. Mm-hmm. They dedicate their lives to teaching children. We have a lot in common with them, but you just have to look at it from there and validate their point of view. And a lot of times when I do talk to teachers, I don't look at it from the student's point of view. I approach it from the teacher's point of view.
Yeah.
So, okay, what's the difficulty little Sally is, I don't know who Sally is, but Sally's having in the class. Wow. She must be, how do you teach with her disrupting you like that? I literally validate and then look at it. Like, how do I get Sally to stop disrupting the teacher? And I just go about it in a way that validates them. And the, you know, teacher recruitment is the term for it. Teacher recruitment increases.
There you go. There is a golden nugget. If there was one for the episode, and there's been a lot of golden nuggets in this episode, I have to come back to one. You mentioned something earlier about automation of writing, and I didn't ask it in the moment because I wanted to continue on, but I know there's people out there listening that wanted me to ask this question. You mentioned before third grade, you're really going to focus on that automation of writing. What about beyond third grade? Are you still focusing on automation of writing, or are you using accommodations, or what are you thinking about for those students who are in fifth, sixth, seventh, maybe even high school that haven't automated writing?
I am not focusing on automating writing when they're older, because the speed in which the class is moving is so much faster than any type of gain that I could ever build for that child. If I sat there and practiced every day handwriting with them, there's obviously a reason they're not automating it, and I'm not going to fix it in time. Not to say I would never. I still want them writing. I still want them signing their names. I still want them making lists. But I do not expect them to use their writing to learn. And there's a real big difference. I expect them to write, but not to learn from what they're writing. I want them to use a way that works for them. So whether it be verbal, speech to text, typing, fill in the blanks, any type where I'm going to reduce the demands on that learning activity. Mm-hmm. Because if that writing is not automated, it is in the way of learning. So I'm not going to use something that makes learning harder to learn. And when I put it that way to the team, it makes a lot of sense. Like, well, yeah, writing is very hard for him. Why would we add writing to geography? Yeah. You know, so I remove the writing so we could focus on the geography, but I don't ever stop them from writing. But in the older grades, third grade's like wishy-washy, right? So it depends where we are in third grade. But like fifth grade and up, I am not working on making that child's handwriting any neater, because the motor plans they have are automated. They may be incorrect, but they're automated, and they may be ineffective and make things harder, but they're their motor plans. Like, and you can see that in a handwriting sample. If you look at like a D and it's written the same upside down backwards way, the whole thing across, that's an automated D. Try to change that D. Now, instead of thinking about geography, they're thinking about a D. That you're impairing their ability to learn. So, yeah,
and trying to make them take notes is just making the situation worse, probably.
And think of the working memory and cognitive flexibility and alternating attention demands of taking notes. Take out the visual piece, even just those cognitive demands of taking notes. And if you have difficulty with those demands, are you learning anything, or are you just copying stuff? Yep. So in today's technology world, like, I can't, and I have to say, I really haven't seen a lot. They are giving the kids the stuff now in the older grades, because it's on the classroom. That's
amazing. Yeah. Like, I mean, that's why I love podcasts. I can hit rewind. I don't have to worry about taking notes. I can go back and listen to it again. That's why right now, today, we are recording this session using what's called Otter AI. So that way we can go back and check the transcript. I don't have to take notes again here. Like, notes is hard for me, and I figured that out sometime during my life, and I just stopped taking notes during class. I just listened, and that was more beneficial for me. I know that isn't for everyone, but that was definitely something that helped me, was just understanding that.
I'm the exact opposite. I have to write it down, or it doesn't go in my brain. So I can't listen to anything. Like, I'm holding myself back from writing notes as we're talking. But the fact that we know as adults how we learn best, you know, taking some time to honor our students and figure out how they learn best, and then advocating for them as an occupational therapist is kind of a huge part of your job. And they listen when we, you know, the people, and I know a lot of therapists have difficulty with parents that are like, no, he needs OT. You need to work on his handwriting. His handwriting is horrifying. I can't even read this. When you explain it to them that, you know, he's going to focus on D instead of geography, they get it. But no one's ever said that to them. All they see is, and the problem with handwriting is such a visible difficulty. Like, it's right there in your face. And and people judge handwriting. They judge your intelligence by your handwriting. Mm-hmm. So I get it being very important, but we're talking about learning, not handwriting. I mean, the purpose of school, the purpose of this classroom. And thank goodness for technology. And then the technology is really going to help so many of our kids. And it's just getting better and better. Yeah. And
agreed.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. Agreed. All right, Lori. Well, it has been a real pleasure. But before I let you go, I want to ask, where can anyone interested in learning more about you and more about using occupational therapy to support students with ADHD, where can they go to learn more?
Well, I have the website, which is www.otforadhd.com. And there's tons of free everything on there, posts and ADHD fact sheets. And then I was going to make a little thing for the listeners of this, where we could QR code. I was kind of throwing it around, QR code, just like direct articles for certain issues. Like the issue with sitting, or the issue with handwriting, or the issue with, I can't even think of all the issues. There's lots of issues. But right. When I say issue, it's because it's not the kid. It's not the environment. It's together. It's an issue. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to put that up at www.otforadhd/school.
Can I put it together? I think it's going to be otforadhd.com/otschoolhouse. So her website, and then add an OT schoolhouse at the end, and that'll take you there. And if it's even easier, you can just head on over to otschoolhouse.com/episode140. We'll have all the links there for you as well. So everything that we talked about, we'll put it right there for you, so you can find it easily. So Lori, one more time, thank you so much. I really appreciate having you here today. And I look forward to definitely staying in touch, because I know you have so much to share and we just touched the surface of it today. So thank you.
Great. Thank you.
All right. And that is going to wrap us up for episode number 140 with Lori Flynn. Be sure to check out all the resources from this episode over at otschoolhouse.com/episode140. And also be sure to check out Lori over on Instagram at OT4ADHD. You won't regret it. She has so much valuable info there. And I know she's only going to continue to add even more value for every occupational therapy practitioner looking to support students with ADHD. All right. Well, thank you so much for listening in today. I really hope you appreciated this episode with Lori Flynn. And once again, Lori, thank you so much for joining us. If you're listening to this episode over your holiday break, I hope you are having a wonderful break. And if you're listening to this another time, well, thanks for joining us. Really appreciate you being here. And if you enjoyed this episode, I would love for you to give us a review over on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you listen. 5 stars is wonderful. Or, you know, just click that copy link and share it with a friend who would enjoy this episode. That means even more. So thanks again for tuning in, and we'll catch you next time on the OT Schoolhouse Podcast. Take care.
Thank you for listening to the OT Schoolhouse Podcast. For more ways to help you and your students succeed right now, head on over to otschoolhouse.com. Until next time, class is dismissed.